My cell phone has already rung under the podium, so we got that out of the way. I brought it up here, so I have a... I mean, the good news is I bring a clock with me, but the bad news is I never remember what time I start, so... Well, I told Lee to call me if I'm running long, so... My name is Beth Hartley. I'm an alcoholic. Amen. Because of God's grace, AA, and sponsorship, I've been sober since June 26, 1988. And, yeah... That just amazes me, because I got to tell you, 10 days was a really long time for somebody like me to not drink. And if you were hanging out with me, it was even longer for you while I wasn't drinking. I want to thank the committee so much for asking us here. It is such a such an honor to get to speak, and especially to get to travel with Chuck. We've been married a long time, and we still like each other, so we enjoy traveling together, and the Atlanta Roundup has a special place in our heart. We met in AA and fell in love in AA, and when we got married, we're going to honeymoon, and we thought we wanted to spend the end of our honeymoon at an AA convention, because why wouldn't we? I mean, we met in AA, and this was back when, you know, nothing was online. You had to read the back of the grapevine to see, you know, get lists, and so we wrote, we lived in Cincinnati, and there were two conventions that weekend that we could make it home just driving on Sunday. One was the North Carolina State Convention, and the other was the Atlanta Roundup. So I want to let you know, this will make me cry, that in 1992, Chuck and I honeymooned here at the Atlanta Roundup, and we celebrated 20 years of marriage last week. So... So we really like it here, and you know, we have friends here, friends we've never met, friends we've known for years. You know, two gifts that I've gotten in AA is history with people, good history with people, and you know, meeting people and just instantly feeling like you've known them for years. And none of that was on my list when I got here. You know, if you are new, how many people are in their first 6 months in here? Oh, good. Well, I'll tell you what they told me, which is if you make a list of what you want right now, you will sell yourself so short. And I thought, what we all think, yeah, whatever. You know, and I got to tell you that I would have, when I got here, I wanted my driver's license back. I wanted to stop getting arrested. And I wanted to maybe someday remarry, preferably to a guy with a job this time. You know? That was my list. You know, I never could remember to ask that stuff at last call. You know what I mean? Like, do you have a job? You know, are you married? It just never came up. Yeah. Oh, like you didn't date at last call, right? Yeah. Now you know why I'm not the Sunday morning spiritual speaker. So. Anyway, you know, what we've ended up with is a life beyond our wildest dreams. And Bill Wilson talked about being rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, you know, and that is it's just so true. And it's just something that happens while we're here, and sometimes we don't even notice that it happened. I had gotten concerned recently. It's gotten trendy on almost every TV show for some character to end up in some recovery meeting. And, you know, they just look so stupid on TV. And you think, I'm thinking, stop that. It looks so lame. You know, people are going to think we're lame. And then I realized I thought we were lame, you know, right up until I didn't, you know. And the only thing that changed was my heart as a result of working the steps. It's the same people, same meetings. You know, so if you are here and you think we're all lame, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because we will be right up till we're not. I wasn't a stranger to AA. My dad got sober when I was 7 years old. And, oh, yeah, I'm 53. Lyle there, so there. Lyle likes to sit and figure out how old everybody is while they talk. So I'm 53. I got sober when I was 29 and a half, and so you won't have to do all that math later. But when I was 7 years old, my dad got sober, and I was an only child, and I lived in a small town, Oxford, Ohio. where Miami University is, and that was my first resentment. I did not want to be from Ohio. I was born in California. By the time I was six, I knew I was born in California, and I was very annoyed that they had moved to Ohio. I was in the first day of school in first grade. I was looking. They had a big United States map on the wall, and there, you know, there's California and Florida and Texas and, you know, oceans, and then there's Ohio. And and I remember thinking, you could look at a map and tell that nothing is happening in Ohio, you know? What I know now is that at 6 years old, I was already restless, irritable, and discontent. At 6 years old, I was already looking for outside stuff to make me feel better. If I lived somewhere else, if I had a brother or sister, if I had, you know, I mean, I grew up in the era of Marsha Brady and I had curly hair, so I was just doomed from the start, you know. All the popular girls had long straight hair, part of the middle. I had a cowlick, it was over. And, you know, but so now I'm from Ohio. I'm an only child. But my dad's an AA, and I don't really even remember his drinking. I went to meetings as a kid. I was at the Friday night Hamilton, Ohio meeting. I was the one over in a corner with a coloring book. You know, they smoked indoors back then, and I knew the AA was full of old men who drank coffee and ate donuts because I'd seen it myself. Now, my dad was 33, you know. So all you guys were old. But I knew AA existed. I knew if you were alcoholic, you didn't have to drink. He told me some of the tragic losses of his drinking. When I started to drink, I felt really bad for him that he had such a hard time. I just always kind of thought if he drank more like me, he could have hung in there longer, you know? But what having a sober parent did was it made me very careful to never, ever wonder if I was alcoholic. You know, because I've heard other speakers say they sat in the bar and went, oh, I'm alcoholic, who cares? And you can't do that with a sober parent. I knew I could not connect my name and the A word in a sentence together, or a big book would fall out of the sky, you know. The bartender would hand me a meeting schedule and the AA police would come take me to a meeting. So I might be slowing down or not mixing those anymore, or, you know, any number of things, but I never, ever said I never said alcoholic in the same breath with my name until I was at an AA meeting in 1983. I mean, I just didn't. So, you know, so I'm an only child growing up. I was an avid reader as a kid. That's, I think, why I did well in school. It wasn't any kind of work ethic. If it looked hard, I just didn't do it. You know, but because some things came easily to me, and I didn't know when I came around AA a few times, I did not walk in the doors and say, oh, thank God I'm home. I want what you have. You know, this is the last place I wanted to be. And I passed through several times on important missions like staying out of jail. Never really to get sober, just, you know, just get the heat off. And I don't know where I was going with that one. Oh, well, it'll come back. But when I passed through, they talked about being self-centered. And I didn't understand what that meant. I thought being self-centered meant selfish and vain. And, you know, I'm not selfish. Just ask me. And, you know, vain, heavens no. And I'm just the most loving, giving person I know. And humble, too. You know, so, you know, like I was going to talk on humility tonight, but there's not enough people here. So. I didn't know that self-centered meant if I'm not good at it, I'm not going to do it at all. And I didn't know that self-centered meant if two people lean their heads together and talk when I walk in a room, I think they're talking about me. And I didn't know self-centered meant if I can't win, I don't want to play. You know, I didn't know self-centered. I mean, I didn't know self-centered meant you will never, ever see me try something new in public because I might fail and then you'll talk about me. You know, and that's how I live my life. When I got here, the big book says the world, we find through inventory that the world and its people dominated us. And I didn't really understand that because when I got here, I was a biker. I had my own Harley. I ran around with a lot of very large people that wore black leather. And so, you know, I'm thinking physical domination, and that just was never part of my story. But what I've come to understand is what dominated me was what you thought about me. That the whole time I'm telling myself and you that I don't care what you think, I desperately cared what you think. Because I'm trying to, because how I felt about myself totally depended not even on what you thought of me, but on what I thought you thought of me. And if you understand that, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're in the right place if you know what that means. I had to arrange your perception of me so that I could be comfortable. And that takes a lot of time and a lot of energy. And that's what dominated my life. Who do I have to be so you'll like me? Who do I have to be so you'll give me this or you won't give me that? Or I can hang out with you or I don't have to hang out with you. And it was all, it's a lot of work living like that. And, you know, that's the self-centeredness the book was talking about. But I didn't have a clue. So I got into school. School came easily, again, I think because of reading a lot as a kid. And so, you know, I had great grades. I'm a test taker. I'm one of those people that, you know, we can like read something, spit it back on a test, get a 90. I mean, if I'm breathing, I'm going to get a 90. That's just how it goes. It's great for treatment. I ace treatment every time I went. You know, you can be a rock star in treatment if you're a test taker. And but socially, I just couldn't, you know, I don't know how to have conversations with people. I don't know what to say after my name's Beth because I feel like you're waiting for the rest. And so I would, you know, if I meet somebody new, I would say, I'm Beth. And she'd say, well, hi, I'm Mary. And then, I know it's my turn to talk, you know. Now the entire committee in my head has launched telling me it's my turn to talk. And they're all, are, you know, they're just, well, you should say something. Don't say something now. You'll look stupid. Well, you're going to look dumber if you don't talk. And it's like, they're up there arguing. I'm paralyzed. We have to go. Can't go back there again, you know. So, welcome to my head. Chuck and I were doing an institution meeting a couple weeks ago, and I said something about all the voices in my head, and he goes, like, don't say that here. And I was like, sorry, never mind, let me out. But I was very busy, you know, because what I know now is if I was alone, I was in an unfriendly place, because I did have all these voices in my head. None of them liked me. I couldn't. There was not one friendly voice up there. And they told me things like, nobody likes you. The kids only play with you because their moms make them. They're all laughing because you fell down playing kickball 6 years ago, you know. I mean, I just couldn't. So I was one of those over, you know, pep club, drill team, cheerleading, yearbook staff, honor society, student council, you name it. I was busy, 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 because I had to be. Because if I stopped, it was too loud. If I stopped, there were too many voices in my head that didn't like me. And so I had to stay ahead of the noise. I had to stay, I played, you know, next door at families with a lot of kids. I had to stay ahead of the noise because if it stopped, you know, I have a boat's going big, fast in the water, and then when it stops, it just sinks. I mean, that's just kind of how it was. And when I took a drink, I didn't have to do that anymore. Now, before that, I wouldn't have told you, really, you know, one of the things that's come along is I'm seeing how alcoholic all my thinking was before I got sober. And what really illustrated that to me was my daughter, who was 4 when I got sober. And we would have told you she would be here by now. I mean, when she was 5, we're just looking like, oh, holy cow, you know, it's on. And, I mean, Chuck and I used to tell people, you might be saving for college, we're saving for treatment. Oh, yeah. So when she was 11 years old, she wanted to be on a swim team, and a lot of her friends were swimming, so we took her, we got her a few lessons and took her to try out. And the coach told her she could be on the team, but that he wanted her to practice down in age group because she didn't have much experience in the water. So he said, well, you can, I think you'll be fine, but practice down in age group because you can't keep up with your age group yet. So this meant at 11 years old, this guy wants her to practice with 9-year-olds. Yeah, I know. You know, and that was okay with her. Now, I was 7 years sober, and I was barely making it, you know. Because my kid is swimming with the 9-year-olds, and she's 11, you know. It was okay with her. And she went to her first race because she only was swimming a couple weeks before the first swim meet. And these were USS teams where, you know, there's 20 teams and just heat after heat after heat. And then they post the results. She was 70th out of 72 in her first race. And she went back the next day. I would have been trying to get my parents to move. And we told her, well, Sarah, you know, you didn't win this one, but now you have a baseline time. And in your next race, even if you don't win that race, if you beat your time, it's still a successful race. Now, the whole time I was telling her that, I was thinking, oh, yeah, right. You know, I mean, get the ribbon. Come on. She beat her time, and she was happy, you know. And the rest of that story is 2 years later, she was a state AA swimmer. You know, 2 years later, she was swimming all over the Midwest, short course and long course. And I, you know, at 11 years old, she never had a drink and neither had I when I was 11. But we reacted to that totally differently. If that had been me, I would have missed all of it the day he told me to practice with the 9-year-olds because I couldn't have gotten in the pool. I absolutely couldn't have done it. And I started to realize that she and I react differently to life. And that really she doesn't even really react to life. She just lives life, which I guess some people do. I mean, Chuck and I started watching her with interest after this swimming thing because we're like, do you think that's normal? I don't know, you know. I mean, who are you going to ask in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? So we started watching with interest to see what developed next, and she, you know, she just kind of went on like that. Now, here's a kid who had this bright future in Alcoholics Anonymous at 5, and she just threw it all away at 11. Just took this wild turn on us. And she, you know, she graduated from the same school system where she started in kindergarten. She had the same friends 12 years later. She did 12 years of school in 12 years, you know. She got summer jobs and saved money. She just, when she was in 11th grade, they opened a Starbucks in our town. And she came home from the school and said, you know, we went to Starbucks after school today. And I said, great, who'd you go with? And she said, Lindsay, Katie, and Jennifer. And I went, Jennifer? And she looked at me and goes, for God's sakes, Mom, that was sixth grade. Could you let it go? No. And Chuck and I she was about 14, and Chuck and I said, you know, there's supposed to be one mature person in the house, and we think it might be you. But she's, you know, she's 28 years old now, and she's married. She decided in high school that she wanted to go into the military, and then when she got out of high school, she went into the military. She's still in the military 10 years later, one job for 10 years. She's actually coming out on August 10th. She'll be done, so. She just did a third tour, and she's got a 5-year-old, and she just, you know, she didn't want to miss any more of that. But, you know, she got married, and then they had a kid. I mean, just on and on and on. She just kind of pats me and Chuck on the head, and, you know. But anyway, you know, watching that swimming thing develop, it really let me see how off I was long before I took a drink. And the book says that drinking's a symptom, you know, that we are self-centered, that my thinking's off, because, you know, all of this allergy stuff I can set in motion when I take a drink, but I am sober when I take the first one, you know. I mean, I'm allergic to penicillin, too. If I take penicillin, I will be like an Easter egg tomorrow with a rash, but never once have I sat and schemed ways to successfully take penicillin, you know? I just haven't. So there's something about the alcohol. And, you know, Sandy B gave a great talk about, we get in here and we, you know, the old timers tell us, folk, you know, God is the solution. It doesn't matter what the problem is, God's the solution. And it's so hard to grasp that because, you know, I think my solution to not enough money is more money. And you know, but what he pointed out is really we're already living like that. When we get here, we're just using a different one solution. You know, if I have money problems, I can walk into the bar and 3 drinks later, I not only don't have money problems, get everybody else a drink too, you know. I can get that thing that strikes fear in all of us, a certified letter, and 3 drinks later, I intuitively know how to handle that situation, you know. Rip up the letter, you know. So I spent my drinking years turning to one solution no matter what my problem was. You know, and that's all that we do here. If you're new, it's just a more reliable solution. But I always did have one thing that would fix anything. And I could read those promises, and alcohol used to do what God does now. So anyway, I get to high school. I haven't had a drink yet, and I finally take a drink at 15 years old, and I just relaxed. I didn't get falling down drunk. Because some of my friends were starting to experiment with alcohol, and they were falling down and throwing up and looking bad. You may have already guessed, I do not like to look bad. So I just put on enough of a glow that I could take my friend out to drink with me the next night so I'd have somebody to drink with. And our friendship didn't make it another year because we drank different from the start. From the very beginning, I knew, I don't remember thinking this is the answer, but if I could have access every day, I would have been a daily drinker at 15. The only thing that kept me from daily drinking was lack of alcohol. And I love to drink. I was not a falling down drunk. I wasn't a fighting drunk. When fights break out, drinks get spilled. And, I wasn't a crying your beer drunk. I just was a happy. I would have told you I was a social drinker, and the more I drank, the more social I got, Hence the last call dating. So I just love to drink. I didn't have issues with morning drinking because it just makes sense. In high school, you have to sober up before your parents get home. I could drink a lot from the beginning. I had a huge capacity for alcohol, so I could drink with the big boys, and I did. When I got to AA and they said hang out with the women, I was horrified because I just thought, I didn't even drink with women. Why would I? I could keep up with the men. Because drinking with girls in high school, when you're drinking with the girls, they giggle and they fall down and they throw up and everybody likes the same boy and, they're wearing pink in public and, and then later it gets really complicated because there's, that was your husband, I'm so sorry, and it's just easier to avoid the girls. But anyway, I drank my way through the rest of high school. Went off to college, flunked out of college, went in with high test scores, but, I guess it's helpful if you go to class, and I just couldn't because I somehow plunked myself into the middle of a 21 state to go to college. It didn't hit me till I was 17 years sober that I spent my childhood trying to get out of Ohio, and then I went to Indiana to go to college. So I don't know what, it was just the path of least resistance, which is what I tend to do. So, one semester I'm done with college because I can't go to class because I have to talk to you sober and I don't know what to say after my name's Beth and I just can't do it. And I come back to Ohio and I know I disgrace my parents because it's a little college town and everybody's watching. So I got a job in a bank because that seemed like the next most respectable thing to do, and banks work Monday mornings, so that was over pretty quick. And a friend of mine had a friend who had a friend in Florida, and he said, we should go, and I said, we should. I had wanted to run away from home since I was 10, I waited till my parents went to work, and I snuck in the house and packed and, ran for the border and literally watched the rearview mirror of the truck all the way through the state of Kentucky expecting the police to come pull us over and make me go home. So I got down there and I got a job in a convenience store because I'd worked in one in Ohio. And I went to this little tiny town, Bonita Springs, Florida, in 1978, two traffic lights and a dog track. That was a whole town. So I didn't know it was so transient down there that if if I worked 3 days in a row, I was management material. So, so 2 weeks later, I call my mom and say, I'm alive. I'm in Florida. Don't worry. I'm assistant manager at the store. And she asked me why I didn't tell her we were moving, which I thought that was kind of dumb since I ran away from home and would have kind of defeated the point. And she, I just heard, how you tell your parents something and you just get that silence on the other end of the line while they digest what you said. And just this little voice on the other end of the phone said, Beth, you're 19. You could have just moved. And I just thought, what? I was a 19-year-old runaway, I didn't even know I could move. I had to run away at 19. So So now I'm in Florida, and, you know, people there drink like I drink. I found my people there. I mean, the whole town's 3 miles long, and we buy beer on this end of town to drink on the way to the bar on this end of town. Those are my people. And by the end of 8 months, I am out of places to work. I'm out of people to date because there's only 3 bars in that town. And I'm thinking I'm going to have to go back to Ohio, which would have meant violating one of two rules that I live by. You know, I mean, one rule I live by, and my parents never taught me these things. I came up with them all on my own. One was, it's not all right not to know. You know, do not ever ask a question, because then they'll know, like, could I move? I'm 19. You know, don't ask. They'll know you don't know. And the other one was never, ever, ever admit that you have made a mistake. You know, and if I had moved back to Ohio, I would have been admitting that I made a mistake and that I couldn't take care of myself. And it was looking bad. And about that time, a guy moved to town from California. Now, I had a friend in Ohio who said, really, they should have put a sign at the state line of Florida, Arizona, and California that says, this state doesn't work either. And if you see a car pull up and see somebody read it and just kind of slump and turn around and leave, that's the alcoholic. And but he missed the sign, and, you know, he had everything I was looking for in a man. He had a house, a car, and a job, you know, and he was 6'2 with tattoos. It just was, you know, God is good. And and so we started, you know, I said for a long time there just really never should have been a second date, but there wasn't, you know. I mean, last call, move in, you know, 5 years later, there we are. And, you know, so that was another example of never admit when you're wrong, just going very badly. So, you know, what should have been a one-night stand just dragged on for 5 years. But we did have 2 children in that marriage, and they're my proof that God can turn any chaos to good. But, you know, the whole marriage, it was, you know, 5 years beginning to end, and 2 kids, lived in Bonita Springs, moved to the Keys, same thing. You know, went with a 6-month-old baby on 4th of July weekend, liked it, came home Tuesday, moved Friday. Hey, Mom, we moved to the Keys, but don't worry, I'm assistant manager at this, you know, whatever. And she asked me something, she asked me a lot, which was, how can you do something that stupid and land on your feet? It just made her crazy, you know. But I did, and I counted on it, I think, on some level. I was like that guy in the cartoons that's walking down the sidewalk and the safes and the pianos are just crashing behind him, you know. And every now and then I get clipped. But I never really got crushed like I should have. And that happened over and over and over. And I just kind of always knew on some level that I would somehow skate through. I would have consequences, but never what they should have been. You know, I totaled a car at 16. I didn't get a DUI. I just got a bill from the county for bridge repair. I got suspended from school one time, and it snowed, so there was no school. You know, I mean, that's just kind of how I lived. And so we're down in the Keys, and I finally, you know, I desperately went out of this marriage, and I can't leave because it would be my fault, you know. If I leave, then I've said I made a mistake. So I just drank till he said get out, which is what I was waiting for, because now it's his fault. And you know, and we had some other kind of drama going in there. I mean, one thing I try to mention, but, you know, not in great depth, is I was a child of the 70s. There was a lot of stuff floating around besides alcohol. I did almost all of it. You know, my drug of choice is yours. Free is my favorite kind. And, you know, but my experience with drug use is that gradually, one by one by one, the drugs started to interfere with my drinking. And anything that gets between me and a drink has to go. I mean, I put down every one of those drugs one at a time because they were just interfering with my drinking. You know, I put down the pain pills pretty early because they just meant I would black out at 6 o'clock instead of midnight. And, you know, I just this other stuff, you know, there's a lot of that in the Keys, and that was kind of my I'm not drinking drug. And I do, Mary likes this, I get a little wistful over the diet pills every now and then, because it's the only time in my life that I could drink for days. I was skinny and my house was clean, you know. I miss the clean house, but but I just, you know, if you're between me and a drink, you're gone. You are mowed down or you're invisible. And by the time I was done, that included my integrity, my employability, my children, relationship with my family, anything. I had just pretty much cut ties to everything, and I moved back to Ohio, kind of against my will, but I had gotten in a little trouble down in Florida. We'd start, it's really expensive in the Keys, so we'd started this little home-based business, and it was a part-time job, you know, which is what I tried to explain to the probation officer after they arrested us, but she said, well, you know, gosh, Beth, we call that sale of a controlled substance down here. So, but I just, you know, I thought of it as a little extra money. And, you know, and I really, that's the first time I got in trouble I thought I might not get out of. But again, somebody made a mistake. And, you know, I came out of there with a couple years of probation. And they thought it was all his fault. And I wasn't going to tell them he was too stupid to run a business like that. You know, that I was the kingpin, but that's okay. So I just went, you're right, he's a terrible influence. And so I moved home to mom. And 1984, I found myself back in Ohio. Now, I'd been to one AA meeting in 1983 because I had a great job in the Keys. I worked at this oceanfront restaurant, an oceanfront resort. I started out in the restaurant, but I ended up going in, being their night auditor, and this was a hotel with 7 bars, and I got the keys to all 7 bars, and they paid me. Yeah, I know. It still could be, to this day, the best job I ever had. And, I mean, it was just a wonderful place. I mean, Keys and Tiki John, you know, Tiki John's Rum Runners, and all the security guards were bikers. It just was a wonderful, wonderful place to work. And I went to happy hour one day, and I was still there at 11 when I was supposed to be clocking in, and so I got fired, and I kind of intuitively knew I wasn't going to find another job quite like that anywhere else. So that's the first time I went to an AA meeting and said that I was an alcoholic. You know, I went with my dad every now and then if I was home visiting, but I would say, my name's Beth, I'm with him, because I'm not saying the A word. But in 1983, I went to the Tuesday night Key Largo group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, my name's Beth, I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, they were all very nice. It was a little discussion meeting, and they're all relating to each other. And it was over at 9 or 9:30, and they invited me to Perkins. And, you know, I'm just thinking, okay, I'm 24 years old. Got a Harley parked out there. It's 9:30 at night, and I have been invited to Perkins. My life is over, you know, because I, you know, when you're new, you go, we get here and you go, what do you do for fun? And everybody's like, oh, we go bowling and we have dances and we go out for coffee. And you're like, what do you do for fun? You know, and a year later, I'm going, we go bowling and we have dances. You know, so your attitude and outlook on life does change. So, anyway, I went to my boss down there and told him I knew I had a problem and that I was going to AA, and they had put the weekend girl up to full-time. She didn't want to work full-time. Everybody hated her, so I got my job back. You know, one meeting, AA works, it really does. And so I went to the Friday night Key Largo group, told him I got my job back, and that was pretty much the end of my AA history in the Keys. But I called my dad and told him that I went to a meeting and said I was an alcoholic. And within a week, I got this box in the mail. And it had a big book and a 12 and 12, each day a new beginning, 24 hours a day, one day at a time, a cassette tape of his talk, a few pamphlets. You know, I don't know how long he'd been throwing it all in the box, but one meeting, boy, it was in the mail. And so now I go back to Ohio, and I think, okay, fine, you know, maybe I should try AA again. I really thought if I just quit drinking with bikers, life would calm down. But my mom lived in one of those neighborhoods that stepped off the pages of an L.L. Bean catalog, and so I went to one of the bars in her neighborhood, and the only guy in the whole place in a Harley shirt sent me a drink. So that experiment failed. And I got to tell you, in 1984, Young People's was on fire in Cincinnati, Ohio. Icky Paw had been in Cincinnati in 1983, International Conference of Young People. And they were lit up there. They had a Monday night meeting, Monday Night Young People's, that had 200 people. And they had a Friday night live meeting, there's 150 people. And it was active, enthusiastic, structured, sponsored Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I walk into a room full of people, it splits up into two groups, all of you and me. And I didn't know how to say anything past my name's Beth any better there than I did anywhere else. And you guys clearly all knew each other, and you're all laughing and talking, and I don't know what to say. And nobody's really remembering. Now, I know I gave it a good 2 weeks. I'm sure of it. But, you know, nobody's really remembering my name. I probably didn't tell you because, you know, who wants to be new, really? You know, I'm not going to tell you I'm new because then you'll know I don't know. But I went to the bar because that's what I know how to do. You know, I'm okay at the bar. If I got $5, I know who can drink as long as me. I know who shoots pool as well as me. I know who knows where the party is after. I'm fine at the bar by myself. And I drank, and within a year, my children had been removed from my custody because I put them in bed, and I had nothing to drink. And there was a bar down on the corner, so I walked down to the corner bar, and I don't know how long it was, but the phone rang down at the bar, and it was the police asking me to please come home because my 3-year-old son woke up, couldn't find me, came out on the front porch and cried, and the neighbors heard him and called the police. Thank God. Thank God, because, you know, if he had wandered off, I don't know if I would have even known he was gone, you know. And they called me, and I came home, and I was charged with child endangerment. And I ended up, that's when somebody suggested maybe I wouldn't go to jail, because that's 6 months automatic. And somebody said, well, you know, if you go to treatment, they might not send you to jail. So I thought that seemed like a good plan, you know. So I went to the treatment center I could afford, which, because I didn't have insurance, you know. So 6 weeks long, all women, God's cosmic joke on me. And, you know, but I already had a big book, and I've underlined a few things if you want to see what, you know, I found interesting, and have a tape of my dad's talk if you'd like to hear it. And, you know, I'm a test taker. I can talk the talk. And I was the one that they came to get to talk to other women who didn't want to leave their kids for 6 weeks. And I could say all the right things. Better 6 weeks now than forever later, because if we're not sober, we can't be parents at all. But, you know, the big book talks about having this double life. The one we want the world to see, and the one we know is true. And I had this problem developing while I was in treatment, because what I was beginning to realize was that I did not want my children back. My kids were at my mother's house, and as much as my, you know, as much as I just hated my mother, those kids at her house got breakfast every day. They went to daycare in clean clothes. They got dinner at dinner time. They got a bath before bedtime. She read them a story every single night. They slept in clean sheets, and I couldn't do any of that, and I knew I couldn't do any of that, and I knew they were better off where they were. Now, if you ask me, I would tell you, of course I want my children back. Of course I do, because, you know, you can't tell people that you don't want your kids. I mean, talk about looking bad, you know? So, so I would tell you, of course I want my kids back, but, of course, my actions didn't say that at all, and my dad died while I was in treatment, so that kind of blew my plans to go be sober with him, go be Jim's daughter, because I don't know how to be Beth. I always was Beth the cheerleader, Beth the night auditor, Beth Jim's daughter, because just being Beth is not enough. I do not fill up my space just standing as Beth. I always had to do all this stuff just to fill my space, and I just couldn't do it. And my dad died, and I'm the only child of divorced parents, so I got the insurance money, and I got to drink the way I wanted to drink for the next 2.5 years. Bottom line, the kids stayed at my mom's, and I drank. And by the end of 1987, I'm living in a friend's attic apartment. I used to say it was an attic apartment. It wasn't an attic apartment. It was an attic. It wasn't an apartment till I got there. And I put a bed up there. It became an apartment. But, there was nothing at 2 rooms, no water, no nothing. And that's where I was at the end of 1987, because I couldn't even pay my $200 a month rent. And, you know, my kids would come visit me periodically for the weekend. And I remember, you know, sitting up there. It's bleak. It gets real gray up in the Midwest, kind of starts in November and ends somewhere in April. It's just gray all winter long. And I'm sitting there, and we're huddled under a blanket with a space heater watching Nutcracker on Ice. And I'm saying, isn't it beautiful? It's Christmas, thinking, you know, something's just not right here. You know, something's just not right, but not knowing still that it was alcoholism, you know, because I was one of the many. You know, I think a lot of us can't separate drinking from alcoholism. You know, if drinking was my problem, not drinking would be my answer. But when I don't drink, my life gradually becomes so unbearable that I have to drink again. And that is alcoholism. You know, that's why the third tradition says, you know, we think AA should include all who suffer from alcoholism. Because I don't have to be drinking to suffer from it. If I am not drinking with no solution, I'm suffering, and pretty soon I'll be seeing to it that you suffer too. And because I don't like, who wants to be miserable by themselves, you know? So anyway, I just, somewhere in the end of all that gray, I said this prayer, you know, one night. I just, God, I just can't live like this anymore. You have to do something. I had never tried to kill myself because I knew I would live. I knew I would live, probably be maimed, look bad. No, you know, so. And I remembered that big book that my dad had sent me. Now, I've been in this attic since August. I hadn't unpacked. There was just a path to the couch and the TV and the bed. But I found the box, found the big book that my dad sent me, started to read Bill's story again. I'd read Bill's story every time I went through treatment, because you go to treatment, they tell you the answers are in this book, the design for living's in here, and I'd open up to page one, because who reads the Roman numerals, you know, and I'd open up to page one, and, you know, war fever ran high in a New England town. I'd think, oh, yeah, this is helpful, you know. Okay, there's my plan for living. And but that night I read Bill's story, and it's the first time that I identified. I felt like he felt, and I knew what he meant. And I slept with that big book like it was a teddy bear. And the next morning I woke up, and I just felt relief, you know. Now, have I been sober since then? No, you know. Do I believe that God removed the obsession to drink? Yes. And he did it more, you know. I can find 3 or 4 times in my life that the obsession to drink was removed. But the thing is, if I don't do something to stay surrendered, it's not going to stay removed. You know, I have to take some action after that. And I, you know, I'm great at surrendering when the heat's on, but I was missing that part about staying surrendered, you know. There's a talk by Harry Tebow in the back of AA Comes of Age, and he says that surrender's not an event, it's a discipline. And then, you know, somebody way smarter than me, Tom Brady, connected the dots over to the big book where it says we're undisciplined people, so we let God discipline us by the plan outlined in this book. So if surrender is a discipline, I can stay surrendered by the plan outlined in the book. And, you know, I didn't do anything that day. I didn't pray. I didn't read again. I didn't go to another meeting. I didn't do a thing. And sometime that day, next day, I don't know, sometime within that week, I drank again because everybody in my head convened and just said, oh, you know, you're going to drink. Get it over with. And I drank. But weird things started happening. I was drinking at the Dewdrop Inn in Norwood, Ohio. Lovely place. And there's one in every town. And I'm surrounded by people talking, the bartender's talking about getting sober. I'm shooting pool with some guy who used to go to 405 Oak Street. You know, I mean, it's very weird. And I pretty much didn't drink on and off in early 88. Mostly I was hanging out with a guy who had a bad back and I was stealing his pain pills, but, you know. They never did anything for me, but just twice a week I would try them again just in case they worked this time, you know. I'm nothing if not optimistic. And, he went out of town, took his pills, I drank, and I was as surprised as anybody. But that started a 3-week-long drunk, at the end of which I just thought, you know, I have been here 4 years, and I bet everybody in Florida is going, God, I wish Beth would come back. And I had a credit card at my mom's that I was allowed to take for emergencies, and it was an emergency that day to go to Florida. And so I ran away from home for the second time at age 29, bought a one-way ticket to Florida, went down for my homecoming parade, which, of course, they didn't have because I'd left under this little cloud of cocaine arrests and all that. You know, nobody was really excited to see me. And on June 26, 1988, I was in the Fort Myers airport. I went to book a ticket home, and the credit card was tired, and so was I. And it wouldn't take a plane ticket home, and I didn't have a dollar. I didn't have enough for one drink. Because if I'd had enough for one, I could have got two. You know, if I can get that first one, I can get the second one. But I couldn't bear the thought of being asked to leave the airport bar because it would have been obvious I was looking for somebody to buy me a drink. And even as bad as I felt, my ego wouldn't let me risk that. And I thought about maybe, you know, there's a lot of senior citizens down there. I thought maybe I could just snatch the purse of some little old lady and maybe I get lucky and there'd be cash. That was before debit cards, you know. There's a good chance I get cash, but I was so hungover. And I just knew I would pick on the little old lady that still did aerobics twice a week. She'd run me down and take her purse back, you know. Could see the headline, you know, purse snatcher tackled by octogenarian. And so I did what we do. I called mommy, and she said, well, call me back later, and hung up. And that was not looking good. And she called her friends in Al-Anon, thank God, you know, thank God. Because she, you know, I laid every problem I ever had at her feet. And when she had my kids, I was not grateful. You know, I did what I could to make her life miserable, to make her pay. I was in so much pain, I was going to make her pay for it unconsciously. And I, you know, I can just tell you in one example the kind of daughter I am with untreated alcoholism. When my children would come see me on the weekends, every now and then, Sunday afternoon about 4 o'clock, I'd tell them I was going to, you know, I'm going to try to get an apartment pretty soon so we can live together again. Knowing I wasn't, but knowing they'd go home to grandma's excited and she would have to talk them down and be the bad guy. You know, I set her up for that. That's the kind of daughter I am with untreated alcoholism. That's the kind of daughter I am while I'm saying, butt out of my life, leave me alone, I'm not hurting anybody but me. Scorched earth all the way around. So I called back later as directed, and she said, I booked a plane ticket, but you need to know I'm not really flying you home, I'm flying the children's mother home, and it's just because we're afraid we'll never see you again if we don't. And I got on the plane that day, hadn't had a drink. I had no idea that was going to be my sobriety date. Didn't have a clue. And because she didn't book me a first class ticket, so there's no free drinking there. And really thoughtless of her. And when she picked me up at the airport, it was around midnight, and she drove me straight to the county detox. And I was unamused. But she said, you know, she said, go in or don't. But you can't come home with me. I've done everything for you that I can do. And again, I gave no thought to what that cost her. I'm her only child. That detox was in the middle of the worst part of Cincinnati. It was on the national news a lot back then for violence. And if I had wandered off into the dark, she really didn't know when she left that night if she would ever see me again. But I'm not hurting you, butt out, you know. And I went in, and the next morning I'm laying there in detox trying to get a plan together because, you know, we need a plan. And I got a plan B, and every single thing I could come up with that day, I had tried, and it had failed. I just didn't have one better idea on what to do about any of my life. And I was, you know, I mean, I realized I was 29 and a half years old, and I never thought I'd live to be 30. You know, I didn't have any plans for being 30 because I knew I'd be dead. And there I was at 29 and a half, distressingly healthy. And I just had this passing thought that, you know, whatever those people in AA are doing, it seems to be working for them. And clearly, what you're doing is not working for you. Maybe you ought to just try it their way. And, you know, I didn't know that that was the surrender. I didn't know that was the one. And I made arrangements to go into a hotel for women. That should have been a sign of surrender. But I got out of detox on Friday, a 4th of July weekend. And the 4th was on Monday. So my life was on hold until Tuesday. I couldn't get, my car was impounded. I wasn't sure why. Well, I knew I had charges pending. I figured they had something to do with the car being impounded. And then I later connected the dots. So that's probably why I thought going to Florida was such a good idea that day. But I couldn't get my car till Tuesday. I couldn't get into this hotel for women until Tuesday. I couldn't do anything until Tuesday. And I knew if I went where I lived, I would drink. I knew that. And I scraped together a little bit of money and got a cheap, and I mean cheap, hotel room that was on the bus line that I had to just walk out the front door of the hotel. Hotel is such a an overstatement of what this place was, but I just had to walk out the door, get on the bus, ride it down one. I didn't have to change buses. That would have been too hard. You know, ride it down Reading Road, walk a block, and I was at the AA clubhouse. And the first day, I almost didn't go to a meeting because everybody in my head's like, oh, we've been going to meetings all week. We could take a day off. And this other voice in my head said, you know, you skipped meetings before and you drank. And so I got up and got my food to go, and I got on the bus, and I went down. And first person I saw, somebody who used to bartend where I drank, we looked at each other and said, I thought you were dead, you know. And I went in, and the girl who was speaking that night at 405 Oak Street, where I got sober in Cincinnati, said that alcoholism, not drinking, alcoholism took her to the place where she didn't want to work, she didn't want to take care of her daughter, she just wanted to drink. And I had never heard anyone say out loud that they didn't want to care for their child. That was my biggest secret. That was the one that I couldn't tell anybody. That was the one that if I maybe didn't drink for a day or two, my head would be almost to the pillow and they'd start, yeah, but you don't even want your own kids. What's wrong with you? Because if you don't drink for a day or two with no solution, a lot of guilt can creep in. And so she spoke that night, and I got her phone number, and I stayed for the midnight meeting because I was a bar drinker, and I could not have just, like, left at 10. Thank God this place had a midnight meeting. I got somebody to ride me back out to the hotel, and the next day I got up, and it took a good half hour to call her, you know, because everybody's convening on should we call her or not, and, you know, she doesn't really want you to call her. She's going to say, Beth who? You know, what if she asks you a question you don't know the answer to? But I finally called, and I just said, this is Beth. I got your number last night. I don't have a clue what to say to you. I am just practicing using the phone. And and she just laughed and said, that's what I had to do too. You know, and that's what I did, and that's what I tell new people now. Do not worry about having long, meaningful conversations. Just practice, because I had to use the phone to get used to using the phone, because I used to, you know, anytime I passed through, I got a sponsor, but I would never call, and then if I had a problem, I can't call, because you'll think I only call when I have problems, you know, and so she became my sponsor, and I started going to this big book meeting they had at noon. I went for many reasons. None of them were to learn about the big book. I went because it was at noon, right? So my day's free at 1. Because I was going to maybe go in a halfway house, but I couldn't get into it for a month. And I promised this lady there that I would go to a meeting every day while I was waiting. So it's over at noon, or it's over at 1. My day is free. It's a big book meeting. Now, I knew from my many trips through treatment that you should read your big book every day. I thought this will count, right? I don't have to read at home. And they read an entire chapter every day, so that chewed up half of the hour, so maybe I wouldn't get called on to talk. All good things, you know. And really, to be fair, if I tried to read the book at home, I couldn't, because my brain was sawdust. If I was reading at home, I was either 20 minutes, you know, still on the same paragraph, or I was 40 pages in and had no idea what I read, because I can think and read at the same time. And if I'd even be in the meeting where they're reading it out loud, you know, in my head, I'm reading along with you. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed her. I wonder what it's going to cost to get my car out of impound. I better call that guy later, you know. I hear the page turn, and I'd rejoin you. And I did all that stuff we do. They would go around the room and read. And so, you know, I'm not going to look bad, right? So what am I going to do? I'm going to count to see how many before me, and then I'm going to count my paragraphs to see which one is mine, and I'm going to be sure I know all the words, and how do I want to read it, you know. Rarely have we seen a person fail. 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 So I'm ready, and then some jerk reads 2 paragraphs. There's just one in every room, you know? So this is the condition I came into AA. But God has a wonderful sense of humor. And my day was free at 1 o'clock, but about 4 I realized I had absolutely no life. And I'd be back there at 6 for the 8:30 meeting, because I knew if I went home and sat down, I would stay there. And the people, you know, when that book got read every day, every 13 days we're back at the preface and forewords and the doctor's opinion, chapters 1 through 11 start over. So I was hearing the first 164 pages, you know, every 3 weeks. And I was hearing people apply it not just to their drinking but to their lives sober. And there was laughter in that meeting. There was all, because healthy meetings have laughter, you know. There is health where there's laughter. And those people, you know, what I didn't know was that people who read the big, who go to big book meetings on purpose tend to be the ones who read the book and do what it says. And out of complete laziness, so I wouldn't have to read at home, I had plopped myself into the middle of the most active people in Cincinnati AA. The intergroup office manager, the chairperson of the, you know, steering committee. I mean, they were all at 2 meetings a day. I'm thinking, don't any of these people have jobs, you know? But they were teachers and realtors and, you know, could take, I was the only one not working. But I just fell in with this crowd, and they just sucked me in. You know, they had me answering phones at the intergroup office by the time I was 10 days sober, and they, you know, at about 3 weeks sober, somebody said, Beth, you've been around before. Why don't you write an inventory? And I didn't know I could say I wasn't ready. So I got the big book and followed the directions and read, you know, wrote the 4-step and called that girl who didn't want to take care of her kids that became my sponsor, and I, you know, did my 5th step with her, and you know, we worked through the steps, and my life took off. I mean, by the time I was 4 weeks sober, I talked to the halfway house, and they said, you're doing everything that we would teach you to do. You know, stay here and do it. And that was the second time when I was in that detox. They had a 30-day program, which looked quite attractive to me, and because I could rest up and get a plan, mostly. And, you know, they said something to me. They said, Beth, they wouldn't let me go through, and I was really insulted. But they said, Beth, you know everything we're going to tell you. You could teach this class. You know, why don't you go do it and save the bed for somebody who doesn't have the information? How are you going to argue with that, you know? It might be the first time I did something for somebody else. And so I started showing up, and you know, so I'm through, you know, working through the steps by a month sober, and my life just took off. One of the things that happened early, I think it was 2 weeks out of detox, and I was at a Friday night meeting, and they passed a second basket because a man, a member of that group, lost his daughter that day to a drunk driver. She was 9 years old. And the next Tuesday, he was in that Big Book meeting. And I remember thinking, how could you even be here after losing your daughter? And he talked about how it happened. These two cars were drag racing up Galbraith Road, hit the car she was in head on. It happened right outside a place called Drake Hospital, which happens to be where you went in Cincinnati for a three-day weekend, courtesy of the court system, if you got a DUI. And he was talking about the fact that those people were outside on break when it happened. And maybe one of them saw it and got sober, and maybe it wasn't for nothing. And when I left that day, I was mulling that over and thinking, what if that had been me in the car? You know, what if I'd been the drunk one killing somebody? What if I had been killed that day? What would my kids be left with? Because they had, my word meant nothing to them, you know? I mean, they were invisible around me. What my kids had always heard from me was, I love you, go away, you know, because I just couldn't do it. And I thought, you know, what if that had been me, or what if it had been them? What would their last thought of me have been? And it was like the sky got bluer and the trees got greener. And I felt this thought go by that, like, you know, you have this gift of a second chance. And gift is not a word I ever use in the same sentence with AA. Because I even thought, where did that come from? But it's like, you have a gift. You have a second chance. You can establish a relationship with your kids. And one of the things I always wanted was let's just erase all that. And, you know, we'll go back here and start over. And that day I realized that I might never be a full-time mom again, that I might be a weekend mom for the rest of my life, but if I was, I could be a good weekend mom. I could be where I said I'd be. I could do what I said I'd do. And that was the first time I took life on life's terms, and I began to build a relationship with my children. And the first amends I made to them through action was to stop making promises I couldn't keep, you know, because we make those toxic guilt gift promises. And I just, you know, I started to build a relationship with them by making one promise to one child and keeping it, and one promise to one child and keeping it. And I brought them to meetings with me on weekends, not to involve them in my recovery, but because I knew I'd yell at them all weekend if I didn't. We needed some diversion. And so they came to meetings with me. But what happened was, I learned how to talk to my kids, watching you guys talk to my kids. Because probably my biggest fear getting sober was that I would be unable to ever love my children. I wasn't sure if alcoholism had just completely killed off the ability to do that. Because, you know, we get here and we are just dead inside. And I learned how to talk to my kids watching you guys, because you called them by name and you sat down on chairs to talk to them. Because they were 4 and 6 when I got sober. And you sat down to talk to them so they could look you in the eye. And you asked them to help you go get coffee. And you played games with them. And you knew that they played soccer. And you were involved with them, and their gaze came up off the floor, and they became less and less invisible, and they began to look the world in the eye. And I began to hang out with my kids. And we would do eating meetings and picnics, and when I was about a year sober, we went to one, and we got there, and I told the kids, if you want to go play, go ahead. And, I would always tell them that, but they never went and played, and that was fine. But that day, about half an hour later, my son came and tugged on my leg, and he said, Mom, I just want to let you know if you need us that we're over here playing. And what I realized was, you know, Bill C. from Greensboro says that grace is that moment when we see everything exactly as it is. And what I knew at that moment was, those kids knew they could let me out of their sight, and I'd be there when they got back. And it took a year, you know. And we just, you know, we just trucked on together. By the time I was 15 months sober, I had my driver's license, a car, and insurance all at the same time. I never could get more than 2 out of 3 of those going at once. And usually it was the driver's license that was missing. But, you know, and we went on at Thanksgiving. But by the time Thanksgiving was rolling around in 89, I was coming up on a year and a half sober, and my son's now 7 and a half. And, you know, I started to worry about him a little because he had all these women in his life. You know, he's got, like, his little sister and me and my mom. And, I mean, a little guy that age really needs, you know, a man in his life. And I thought, for his sake, that I probably should start looking around. You laugh. That is the kind of loving, giving mother I am. And we went to 405 Oak Street for Thanksgiving because they would do a big spread. And I went to Noon Big Book because that's what I do. And when I came out, I couldn't find Robbie. And they said, oh, they're across the street. And there was a schoolyard across the street. And there was my 7-year-old son and another little boy and 4 of the guys from Oak Street playing football. And I thought, well, where should a little boy be on Thanksgiving Day except playing football with a bunch of guys? But the grace in that moment was realizing that I did absolutely nothing to make it happen except go to the noon meeting, you know. And I realized if I did what I needed to do, God would take care of his life. I didn't have to micromanage it. So I called off the manhunt and briefly. Somewhere in there, I guess maybe right before that, because I was about a year and a half sober, they had this thing at Oak Street called all-group gratitude and Monday nights, and other groups from Outlying would come in and chair a meeting at Oak Street, and one of their members would speak, and I was like the clubhouse Oak Street girl, so I would kind of roll my eyes at the suburban discussion groups, but it was Mount Washington night, and you know, so this guy comes and talks I've never seen before, so, you know, how sober can he be if I've never even seen him, because I know everybody. And he sat down and just gave this fabulous talk. And, I mean, I never forgot his name, after, which was unusual for me. And I tell him, you know, that when I heard him, I said to myself, you know, I want what he has, and I'm willing to go to any lengths to get it. Chuck's favorite part of my talk right there. But we actually, we didn't start dating for another year. We would cross paths periodically, and then around, you know, he was about turn 2, I was 2 and a half, because he'll probably forget to mention this tomorrow night, but I am sober longer than him. So Casey forgets to tell you, and this is my favorite time of year because my anniversary was last month, so right now I'm 24 and he's not. So, and if he says anything, I just tell him, it's okay, honey, I used to be petty like that when I was only 23. But we started hanging out together, and he had kind of dated like I did at last call, so we made a decision to keep our clothes on and get to know each other, and we courted, you know, and he'll probably tell you more about that tomorrow night. But we, you know, we went out and we got to know each other and we fell in love. We set the wedding date a year away because we had, you know, some credit stuff to clear up. And as the year approached, as our wedding date approached, we wanted more than ever to be married. We didn't have that like breakup, makeup stuff going on. We just, you know, we kind of knew this was like that relationship that grows and deepens with time like it's supposed to. And we have had a great time, you know. Like I said, we celebrated 20 years of marriage last week. And, yeah. And so we, you know, we started trying to, my mom and I had talked when I was a year sober, made the decision that it didn't make much sense to bring the kids to live with me at a year. You know, at a year, I mean, they had been with her 4 years by the time I had a year sober. They were in a blue ribbon school district in a safe, clean suburban neighborhood. I was in a 10th floor efficiency, you know, in a crappy part of town. And there was no purpose served by dragging them down to my level in the name of family unity. I mean, they were doing what they were supposed to do. I was the disruption in their life. And we decided that I would catch up to them instead of dragging them down to me. And I was lucky. Not everybody can do that. But my kids were in a safe place, and I could. And my mom and I worked together on that. And you know, the kids spent more and more time with me. And when Chuck and I got married, we got a house in the neighborhood next to their neighborhood because their neighborhood was pricey. But, you know, we're catching up. We're getting closer. And now we're in the suburbs. And it's funny, we took our cat with us. Somebody else talked about this the other day. We took our cat. Maybe it was Harry. Our cat moved with us. Now, we've been on an alley, you know, in Clifton where there's ambulances and breaking glass and gunshots. And we moved out to the suburbs where there's crickets. And I thought the cat was going to have a nervous breakdown. I mean, like crickets, and he's just like, what's that? An ambulance went by, and you could almost see him go, oh, thank God, you know. I just But we moved out and got close to the kids, and then we were able to move into their neighborhood. When Chuck got his degree, he got a job with insurance, which was kind of the last piece we were missing. Now we could provide health insurance for the kids, and we moved to their neighborhood, and they started 5th and 7th grade, walking out the door of their mom and dad's house like everybody else. You know, and I used to wonder if my kids would ever come back and all that. And my sponsor would say, it's in the book. And I'm, sponsors say that, you know, it's in the book. And and somewhere about 7 years sober, I was flipping through and I saw families will be reunited. And I thought, huh, it was in the book. What do you know? Right again. They had me. It was suggested to me when I was new that I get red lipstick and write on my bathroom mirror, you're wrong, Beth. And I thought, well, that's kind of dumb, you know. I mean, what's it going to, I know it's there if I wrote it, right? But I'll tell you, I did not know how much thinking I did, but from opening my eyes to walk into the bathroom in the morning. And, you know, I would, it was only, I mean, a little efficiency apartment is only about 6 feet. But I, you know, I'd open my eyes in the morning, and by the time I got to the bathroom, I'm already screwed for the entire day, you know. And I would look up and see your wrong Beth, and it's like, oh, thank God, you know. I just... It works, you know. If you're a thinker, try it. Red lipstick. It works. On the mirror. And, you know, so I just, but we have just had the best time. And you know, the kids are now 28 and 30, and Sarah's a wife and a mother and a soon-to-be ex-soldier. And we moved to North Carolina 10 years ago and had no idea. When our son got out of the Army, he moved to North Carolina. My mom moved to Raleigh about a year and a half ago. And when our daughter had to deploy again last July, she made the decision to leave the Army. So her husband and daughter moved to Cary. So at 3 weeks from now, she'll be living in Cary, 5 miles from us. So our entire family's in North Carolina. And, I mean, who knew that would happen? And we just do what we do, what we've been doing, you know. I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous, it's for real. You know, we got a friend who says he thinks that God gave us AA to keep us busy and out of his way so that he could run our lives. And that's really, you know, that's really been my experience. The more I put into the AA side of life, the more God fills up the other side. My balance comes from him if I'm doing what I need to do. You know, if you hear me say I'm going to get some balance, just slap me, because that usually means I'm going to skip meetings. Watch me, you know. Thanks, God, for all this stuff. Now I'm going to take care of it. And so I try to live life, you know, I'm kind of a visual thinker, and I try to live life like this, that I've got a hand out to God, and I've got a hand to AA. So, you know, if I want to grab onto my stuff, which one of those am I going to let go of? I'm going to have to trust God with my relationships and my job and my stuff. And don't get me wrong, I love my stuff. But I know if it was gone that I would be fine, you know. And I just can't describe the joy that I get getting to hang out with you guys on weekends like this, you know, to hear the laughter, God's music. And if you are new, please stick around. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you so much. On behalf...